I was reading in this book by an author named Wendell Berry, who I just love. The book's titled Sex, Economy, Freedom, and Community. He's talking about the nature of humans and how we have a tendency to enthrone God in specific geographical places or buildings, and how while Solomon and Paul note that God does reside in certain places, refuse to allow people they talk to confine God to those spaces. That God isn't kept hostage by buildings or even by ideas. And so Berry picks up by saying this, and he identifies that as idolatry. He says, idolatry always reduces the worship of something made with hands. Idolatry is always reduced to the worship of something that is made with hands, something confined within the terms of human work and human comprehension. Get what he's saying? Idolatry always reduces worship to something that can apprehend, something that we do with our hands, something that we can control. Thus, Solomon and St. Paul both insisted on the largeness and the at-largeness of God, setting him free, so to speak, from ideas about him. He is not to be fenced in under human control like some domestic creature. He is the wildest being in existence. Isn't that good? He is the wildest being in existence. And he says, the presence of his spirit in us is our wildness. Our oneness with the wilderness of creation. Ah, that's good. And so, as I introduced Don, we've been in this conversation as a community for a long time, but in the last month specifically, about this idea of creation and in Jesus coming as the new Adam and us being in the recreation of the world, what is happening and what is still to come, and the idea of becoming more and more in tune, not just with what God is calling us to be in the next life, but what he invites us to be now, to be fully human as Jesus was fully human. And I got to think that as we talk about those issues, what it means to be creative people has to come into play because God is a creative being. And so in a sense, what we're trying to figure out is what does it mean to be creative? And specifically, how do the arts have voice in the context of our community? Because in the church, the arts have always been underneath everything and just served as either illustration or propaganda. You understand what I'm saying with that? And so what does it mean to be led by artists? Tony Campolo talks about the greatest theologians in the church today are artists. And so tonight, I've asked Don to come up and to speak to us as an artist. Don is the founding member of the band Waterdeep, who I'm sure many of you know, an incredible artist and a man of God in a conventional and very unconventional way. And so he's going to speak to us tonight, I think, in some pretty meaningful ways. And if tonight is anything like this morning, Don speaks in a way that sometimes goes over and then comes back to haunt you like 3 hours later. And so I just invite you to open yourself up to the Spirit of God to hear what he might say to you, maybe in some ways that you haven't thought about before, okay? So let's welcome Don.
Hey. Is that working? The haunting, part one. Because it's Mother's Day, I just want to share a couple brief anecdotes a la the mini Mother's Day sermon. My wife and I had a baby 4 months ago, and we went to baby classes or whatever they weren't called. I think we called them baby classes. Anyway, and they were at 6 or 6:30, which was the way it worked out. Do I need to raise this possibly? No, big noise. There. Classes were at 6 or 6:30, and so it seemed like we were always just rushing, and so we ended up eating fast food on the way there, which isn't, you know, that great in the first place and maybe unsettles your stomach a little, but then the first thing in the movie, or the first thing of the class was always a movie of a birth. So I'd be sitting there, like, sipping on a Coke, you know, finishing my last fries, and they fire up the video, and I remember the first time we watched one of these things, I just thought, oh my goodness. You can't believe that mothers, from time immemorial, and it's happening right now, today, somewhere, give birth, and it's this unbelievable feat of strength and endurance and courage and everything like that. And I've been irrevocably changed in the way that I see motherhood, if only for the sake of birth. And then the other anecdote that I wanted to share about was my own mother passed away in July of 2001 of leukemia. And I remember afterwards, a few months after, I often would say that I would give anything to have her come tell me to do my taxes. You know, there's these, my mother would be a bit irritating, and I would, you know, had perpetually rolled eyes on into my 20s with her because she would just nag at me, and, you know, she used to fill forms out with both pencil and pen. Oh my gosh, things like that. And anyway, there are all these things, you know, that just bugged me about her. But once she was gone, I realized they were some of the things that I probably missed the most, some of the things that defined her as a person in a way that I had never realized. And so, just by way of the mini sermon, I just want to encourage you that, you know, while you have your mothers, and whether you do or not, coming to peace with who they are and enjoying them and being able to celebrate them as they are is, I think, a really important part, and really a great opportunity on Mother's Day, you know. So there you go. There's the end of Mother's Day sermon. I did a record with a guy named Jerem Matthews, who's a friend of mine, goes to church here, and we recorded the acoustic guitar by, we had a mic on the acoustic guitar, and then we had the pickup plugged in, and so it was sent to an amp at the back of the room, and then the amp was set in front of a whole stand full of acoustic guitars, like four or five of them, and then we mic'd those guitars from the opposite side, so the amp would be making guitar noise, you know, from the guitar being played, and then all the strings would resonate, you know, they'd just start ringing. Or if you're in a music store and they've got them hanging up all over the wall and you hit a bass, a note on the, you know, a bass, you'll hear a whole music store sort of ring after that. And that's resonance, you know, one thing causes another thing to resonate. And so the goal here today is not necessarily any sort of exercise in good rhetoric, but rather to find something, hopefully, you know, that the Lord will resonate something in you from one of the many rabbit trails that I'm about to take. I think one of the problems of American Christian or evangelical Christian spirituality, which, you know, maybe that's overused and it's tired. Let me just say one of the problems I've had and that I've known a lot of my friends to have is being bad listeners. That reality confronts you. And I'm not talking just about listening to one another, although I do remember vividly fighting with my wife a lot in the beginning of our marriage, and this pastor sharing with us the tip of what I hear you saying is. And so it's a cheesy convention, you know, the idea of saying, well, honey, what I hear you saying is that you're incredibly angry with me, that I frustrate you to no end. Now, and but it's been amazing. What happens is, you know, when you actually go through with it, is that A, you find you have to have listened well enough to repeat back what you heard. B, the person who spoke in the first place hears themselves coming back at them, preferably without your prejudice involved. What I hear you saying is, you're a jerk and everything I do seems wrong. That would be a bad example of active listening. But if it comes back without that kind of prejudice, then the person who had spoken in the first place gets the opportunity to identify the things that they feel either weren't said properly or weren't heard properly, or even, you know, to apologize and things like that. And that whole give and take of active listening is the term they use, which is it's not, in other words, just passive listening, just sitting there and having information hit you. It's the idea of really dialoguing, essentially, is something that I think needs to happen, spiritually speaking, on a whole number of levels. And it happens as a dialogue with things that don't talk expressly. I mean, specifically, they are. And you, by listening to life, you learn to engage with reality, with the fullness of reality. Thomas Merton, who was a monk and Catholic, I had a friend, by the way, who taught a school, sixth graders, and when he was explaining, he was a science teacher, and when he finished explaining a concept, he'd go, eh? And if the class got it, they'd go, eh. And if they didn't get it, they'd go, pfft. So, maybe we'll use that later. Thomas Merton talked about the aim of spirituality being to engage with reality, and that the problem of bad spirituality is that it caused sort of neuroses to form up around protecting an unreality. So what you have is you have real life and what's really happening in front of you and around you and to you, and you don't want to deal with it, and so you develop, you know, as Tim has often said, meaningless God talk to explain things away or to cover them up or to ignore them or to whatever, you know, all sorts of mental gymnastics that we accomplish by doing that. When the truth and the good spiritual thing to do would be to face whatever it is that's difficult, and that in fact, as Christ proves in the Garden of Gethsemane, the greatest human moments are to face those things with a good end. So I really think that part of what the arts help to do, and I've been trying to find a definition for art for a while, I think, because it's not, you know, it's easy. I've heard people say, for instance, art is ultimately like love or something like that, and I think, I don't think so. I mean, there's some really great artists that don't seem very loving, per se, you know? But they're still great artists, and you kind of can't argue with it. And it seems to me that it is this listening thing. It's a reflective sort of thing. You're catching something, or you're being reflected something out of that person's life or the culture or society in which they live or the times in which they live or something. And there's something about that sort of listeningness about them that I think is such an engaging thing. And so when we talk about art and faith being intertwined, it makes a great deal of sense because art is insistent on listening, and spirituality ought to be the kind of thing which is able to confront reality as it is and just simply hear it, you know, not have to try to alter it because it's uncomfortable. And I've been watching a lot of Inside the Actor's Studio lately, and several people who have played villains, Kevin Spacey and Tom Cruise in particular, I remember saying this thing, that the host, James Lipton, who's one of the most dreadfully serious men you've ever seen, resplendent. Anyway, he asks them, how do you play a villain, basically? And there's a common answer, which is that you don't judge them. That you let yourself play them as if they think they're right, because they do, and you try to find out what it is that they're completely obsessed with that they think is so right, you know? And one of the common acting questions is, how am I like this character? That's one of the big sort of things. And I've also heard several actors talk about the opportunity in acting to confront your own emotional terrain, to deal with the fact that certain things that you really didn't think were a part of you are in fact a part of you, that you have villainous nature within you, that you have totally broken down, helpless nature within you. And the fact is that we parade our lives out on display to a great degree, hiding all that stuff because it's uncomfortable and embarrassing or awful. But that not judging thing, I think that's a really interesting thing. And I think that some of the churchy things that we do to avoid dealing with reality as it really is, they have to do with that kind of a thing, that we compartmentalize stuff so that we can kind of break it down to bite-sized chunks. When it really won't suffer that. The fact is that we think we have accomplished something sometimes in the way that we approach our faith in reducing the world. And in fact, we're the one that's become reduced. And the world is going on in its fullness, and life is going on in its fullness, and we're living in a very small closet of a space, you know? So it shouldn't be that way, right? Christian faith ought to be the good news, and it ought to be glorious and everything. And the problem is that that's when we caricature life, we end up inevitably making it not only not good news, but totally irrelevant news. It has nothing, it's a cartoon world, you know, and we don't want to do that. Some of the reasons or some of the ways in which we do that, I think we protect our theology over the truth sometimes. A friend of mine talked about having to give a testimony one time, and he got up and talked about the days when he smoked pot, and he said they were awful and everything, and then he came to Christ and everything was great. And he told me later, he goes, they weren't awful. I had a great time. I remember sitting on a couch listening to Peter Gabriel and just watching people walk by like they were 1,000 miles away. And he said it was just like, it was the greatest thing, you know? And I thought, wow, okay. There's significance to the fact that you enjoyed being high so much, you know? And I think a lot of times we're afraid to look at that. We're afraid to look at those parts of ourselves that feel so incredibly alive when we're sinning. And I think, and I say sinning, I'm not endorsing smoking pot. I'm just saying that there are a lot of things that we do, you know, ranging from things that are as obvious as fornication and pot to video games and eating, you know. And a lot of other things, obviously, but we don't have time to just stop and list a number of sins. And I think that unless you can learn to deal with what really is within you, it could be that there's this sense of being free from worrying about what people think when you're high that was so attractive. It could be that you're so anxious about life and whether things are going to turn out okay that when you're high you don't care. Well, then that tells you something about who you are that that you have to listen to, and just saying I better not smoke any more weed you're not going to learn anything. You might stop that behavior, but I can guarantee you, you know, it's like a thing with air in it. You push down on one part, it swells up somewhere else. It may be a more hidden part, but it'll affect you. It'll show up, you know, somewhere. So we protect our theology over the truth. Because we think that our theology is the thing that will keep us safe. But really, the truth is the thing that will set us free, as Jesus says. We fear our own sins, like in this, you know, pot-smoking thing. We're embarrassed, ashamed, angry in regard to them, and we can't just face them as they are. We desire to control the randomness of suffering. People are hurting, dying, you know, heartbroken all over the place. And so we try to control that. We try to find some way to manage it, including explaining it away. You know, there's a guy named Bebo Norman who wrote a song about a woman that he knew who died, and I can't remember exactly the line, but it was something about, don't just tell me this was her time. That's such a useless line. Or, it was not her time. That's such a useless line. I'm inclined to agree, you know. If it is someone's time to go, it's not on your calendar, and it's not on my calendar. And therefore, I'm not sure sometimes what the relevance of that is to the suffering that we're going through and the losing of them, you know? And maybe, you know, maybe there is something significant to it, and I don't want to push that off into the realm of totally unneeded, but I do think that we should think seriously about whether we're explaining suffering because we're terrified of it, as opposed to because it seems like something that's really true. We also have the desire to control the possibility of evil action in ourselves and others. The Pharisees, who were the Jewish teachers during Jesus' time, were a part of a tradition in which you have the commandments, you know, let's say you got 10 of them. I'm just pulling a number out of the air. And so you're not supposed to, you know, break any of the Ten Commandments, and you decide, well, you know, in order not to covet my neighbor's wife, I really need to not do this, you know, not, let's say, not see anything but her eyes or something. So you put her in a, you know, a gown with only eyes in it. You get the idea. So the point is that these became these hedge laws, and at a certain point, if you break a hedge law, you're in trouble. Well, that's not really breaking the law. It's not breaking a commandment. It's breaking a protective commandment that was made maybe a third or fourth generation away from the original commandment. But our desire to control that possibility of evil is so profound that we'll continue to just make these, get ourselves farther and farther away from the possibility of breaking a commandment, that we in fact begin to restrict our behavior utterly, even in good areas, you know? Like Jesus said, that the Sabbath was made for man, not man for the Sabbath. Everything doesn't center around these commands. Everything centers around God and around the creation that he longs to share with us and the love that he longs to share with us and the relationship that he longs to share with us. And then finally, I think another way that we avoid listening well and avoid, especially in regard to making and observing art, and remember, by the way, as I talk about art-related things, that those of you who aren't artists aren't allowed to tune out, because the fact is that we all interact with this stuff on a regular basis, and I'm also talking in a larger sense about the art of living. I think that's what art gives us, is that gift of being able to listen, but listening is crucial to life, not just to art. So just a little warning, lest you start zoning out and doodling, which is making art. And then finally, longing to experience unbroken goodness now rather than later. We avoid listening because we want so badly to be in a good place rather than in a difficult place. The world is hard. Heaven, as we hear, is going to be resplendent. And we want so much to be there. We want so much to experience freedom from all the painful things that we deal with here, that we hardly even want to admit that some of the things are painful, you know, or hardly even want to deal with them, or just want to sign off, you know, and sign out, rather. And I think that's yet another way in which we become, ultimately end up being poor listeners. So here you have all this listening stuff, and I'm actually going to go a little more specific now and talk about, for me, as a writer, as a songwriter in particular, I've had some kind of new, I'd say rules, except the final rule would probably be don't follow the rules all the time. And so these kind of maybe gentle suggestions in regard to my writing that I've been trying to adhere to, or at least think about. The first one is don't judge. When I'm writing something, I want to be able to follow where it's going to go, and if it heads somewhere that I would consider dark or despairing or sad or angry or frustrating or uncommon or weird or kooky, I want not to judge it and shut it down. I want to be able to follow it and just see what it is, you know, find out what's at the end of this path. And it's surprising how many times you're led somewhere that really is life-changing when you just follow what's interesting or what's moving. The second gentle suggestion that I try to adhere to is not superimposing an agenda on art making. A lot of times, you know, when you're making, well, and I've in the history of Waterdeep, there was a season where we were raising support as music missionaries, was the term that we used, and I think that's a legitimate thing potentially, and I don't know what to make of it now, because I actually feel like, for myself at least, that's not exactly the way in which I want to relate to my art, because I realized at a certain point, if I am primarily a missionary, it, as an agenda, if my goal is to be salt and light kind of a thing, it's potential that that aim could conflict with whatever the aim of art is in terms of reflecting reality, because I might reflect a portion of reality which I would say isn't persuasive. It's not something that suggests to people that, you know, the gospel as we know it of Christianity is good news, right? And so what do I do with that if I've got something that's essentially kind of a bummer, you know, and it's supposed to be part of this larger message? I would say, just by the way, theologically speaking, that there's room for it, because the gospel, the good news of God, is everything. It's all of life. It's the fact that we are here in the midst of it, that Christ came by incarnating, by becoming a human being, to say, hey, you know what? It all happens, and it's all okay. We have to go to the bathroom. That's part of the deal. We have to eat. We have to deal with being misunderstood by one another. Christ, as Tim pointed out during communion, you know, you have communion and you have the elements of the bread, normal bread, the wine, a betrayal, all these things that are incredibly human. And it wasn't just becoming human so that we could, you know, milk him for the blood which atones for our sins. It was becoming human so that he could show us that humanity was intended to be good and is, in fact, good. And so I think When you stack agendas on top of your humanity too much, suddenly you become so burdened down that you can't really live creatively anymore. There's no sense of trusting life enough to let it go where it's going to go without you trying to muscle it down, which ultimately you're impotent to do. You know, there's no way to make it happen. So, and then finally, thirdly, follow the interesting idea. Paul Simon talks about the idea that he loves a first line in a song that has options. He said, if the first line suggests the whole rest of the song to me, I'm not as inclined to try to pursue it. But if the first line suggests to me vistas that are broad and open up and I could go in a number of different directions, he said, then that's interesting to me, you know? And then in each successive line, I want to stay to where I'm engaged and I don't get sick of the idea of the song, you know? I want something that draws me in and is haunting to me or is captivating to me or, you know, those kinds of things. I think that the way I have it written here is, you know, the idea of pulling on the strongest thread or pulling delicately on the prettiest one. You know, when you're creating, don't go with some preconceived notion of how you think things ought to be. Find that thing that just is moving or has that inexplicable, as the French would say, je ne sais quoi. Oh, I cracked myself up. That's a good thing. And then finally, don't be surprised by the need for courage during the creative process. I think I may be asked to change the way I see the universe as the result of something that I write. I may be asked to believe that God is not only at the end of things, but that he's in the frustrating, scary, desperate, or angry middle of things. I may be asked to have the kind of hope that believes despite appearances, not in light of them. And along those lines, as I mentioned, I lost my mother to leukemia in 2001, and I lost my dad a year ago on Easter, and which is what year are we? 2003, I guess, would have been the year. I forgot what year it was, which is on a completely different level from forgetting what day it is, which happens a lot as well. So I read this. I've been reading this Thomas Merton book, and he has a chapter called Sentences on Hope. And after my dad died, and after having this 2 years of pretty difficult stuff, you know, I didn't think I was having a crisis of faith. I didn't think I was angry and denial and all the things that people are supposed to be in after somebody close to them dies. But I was, in fact, in those things, despite the fact that I didn't know it. And when I read this chapter, Sentences on Hope, there was a certain despair in what Merton wrote that made me realize it was familiar to me. And I'm just going to read it first, and then I can tell you more about it. It says, supernatural hope is the virtue that strips us of all things in order to give us possession of all things. We do not hope for what we have. Therefore, to live in hope is to live in poverty, having nothing. And yet, if we abandon ourselves to the economy of divine providence, we have everything we hope for. By faith, we know God without seeing him, and by hope, we possess God without feeling his presence. He gives himself completely to those who give themselves to him. The only thing faith and hope do not give us is the clear vision of him whom we possess. We are united to him in darkness because we have to hope. And then from Romans 8:24, for we are saved by hope, but hope that is seen isn't hope after all. For what a man sees, why would he hope for it? And then finally, hope deprives us of everything that is not God in order that all things may serve their true purpose as means to bring us to God. The idea of saying that hope deprives us of all things, I think, is a pretty interesting idea. I mean, it's so backwards from what you might think. And yet it's been my experience that idea of being stripped... Because if I hope in my wife, or in my father, or in my mother, or in relationships, or in my community, or in, or even in the Bible, you know, when you read about persecuted Christians who have no access to it, and they only have what they remember. If I hope in any of these kinds of things, at some point, it's possible that thing could be wrested from me, it could be ripped away. And then where is my hope? What's my reason for living, you know? And I think the thing is, and this is what Merton is saying, is that those things are not, they can't, by definition, be your hope, because they're visible. Hope is supposed to be something that you can't see. And so all these other things, real hope strips all those other things away until you're in this dark place where all there is God, who is at the foundation and in the firmament. He's everywhere and in everything. And he becomes then, you know, your ultimate hope. The possibility that at the basis of this whole crazy thing, there is someone good, someone loving, someone patient, someone just, someone forgiving, someone strong. I mean, that's the amazing hope, you know? It's not possible, really, to put it into words. And we only hope for little glimpses, little resonances, you know, where our B string gets moving. I wanted to play some songs now because I figure that's a good thing to do. I figure it's maybe the easiest way to talk about. I'm ready for the transition. Check. Oh, look at that. That was seamless. Except that I mentioned it out loud. The Chicago Cubs haven't won the World Series since 1908. And I know, where are we going? And they haven't been in the World Series since 45. Is that right? Yeah, I think that's right. It's been a long time, and Cubs fans are infinitely patient, and they have hope because they have no evidence. This song isn't about the Cubs per se, but I thought I'd share it with you. It references it. And in this song, the narrator is this character, maybe not unlike myself, who's experiencing real despair and trying to figure out how to continue, trying to, you know, kind of get his courage to the sticking point so that he can keep dealing with reality. But is it a particular point at the writing of this song in which he's having a tough time of it? And if Cubs fans are the only inspiration he can find, well, then God bless him, right? Last time I was breathing, I was scared. I never knew what people felt, I never cared. And now the world just opens up like a basement or a coffee cup, like a thermos on a Boy Scout trip that your dad spilled when he lost his grip. And every time I think about it, I don't wanna be sad, cause being sad's too real. And real is like a small insect, it's a never-ending pain in your neck, and you wish that real would just go away. The last time I saw Henry, I was drunk. Shower for a week, man, I stunk. But Henry just opened up after one insincere hey, what's up, and spilled his guts. I guess he couldn't see that every time I think about it, I don't want to be sad, cause being sad's too. Real is like a small insect, it's a never-ending pain in your neck, and you wish that real would just go away.
out the cubs, and how the fans bite their nails down to the nubs. I'm hoping maybe that this year they will finally make it clear that Chicago knows about baseball, that they really got it right this fall. Every time I think about it, I don't want to be sad, cause being sad's too real. Real is like a small insect, it's a never-ending pain in your neck, and you wish that real would just go away. And you wish that real would just go away.
Thanks. This next song is called There Were Tools in the Garage, and it's kind of about the men of my father's generation and his father's generation were a unique breed. I don't know that we're going to see that again. Those guys were something else, you know. And there's aspects of, when I lost my dad, well, that was one of the things I remember thinking, you know, is that men like him aren't around much. You know, there was just a certain kind of the way he related to the world and the experiences that he'd had. He was a fighter pilot in Vietnam, and he quoted Rudyard Kipling regularly, and I don't know, he was just, he was a piece, you know, piece of work. And he was a Christian, but he wasn't afraid of the F word either, and he was just a total bundle of paradoxes, and he was... he was my dad. I mean, that just the whole shooting match. And there was a thing, you know, when I was a kid, and, you know, my dad changed a lot. My mother had a car accident that she nearly died of 10 years ago. And after that, I remember our family softened up like pouring water on dry earth. You know, I remember the intimacies became more frequent. We were able to talk with each other again, or maybe for the first time in a lot of ways, and just things began to be shared because the burden was too great. My mother was in intensive care for a long time and nearly died, and it was really traumatic. And but man, we really drew closely as a result. And then when she went through leukemia, and then my dad had oral cancer, and my wife and I moved in with him and took care of him through that. I'll never forget the way he would lay down. I would come in to clean his tracheostomy because he had the hole in your throat. And I would come in to clean it in the morning and take care of whatever other things he had. I was kind of nursing him, and he would lay down. I mean, here's this man, he's 60-something years old, and he's a fighter pilot in Vietnam, and his son's coming in to take care of him. And it was just, he would lay his head down on the foot end of the bed and close his eyes, and put one knee up on the other one, I remember, and then I'd take care of him. He'd just have his eyes closed the whole time, you know. And those kinds of connections are really, they're really something. And I changed my mind about what song I'm going to sing as a result of it. So sometime, you know, pull me aside and we'll do this other one, you know. Not really, but I'd like to say that. I have this friend from Oklahoma City who is a very funny guy, but when he has a joke that doesn't work, he goes, "Excuse me." And it makes me laugh every time, you know? So I guess it makes all jokes work. But it's not very appropriate at a church, I apologize. Sorry. Every time that I get down, I am like a salmon on
an upstream journey, then death to follow once I spawn. And I've seen the big fish climb the ladder at the reservoir. I've watched them work like devils, half delirious. Do they even know where they are? And Jesus, I'm a sucker. I wish I believed less of the lies. Did anything I thought I knew turn out to be true? 'Cause baby boys and little toys are all that I see anymore. And will somebody close the door? It's cold outside. It's cold outside. Every single time I thought that I had figured it all out, I was run aground again and floundering with crazy doubt. Maybe every way I'd learned to deal with the tragedy was just another junkyard find, rusty and raggedy. I'm a sucker, I wish I believed less of the lies. Did anything I thought I knew turn out to be true? 'Cause baby boys and little toys are all that I see anymore. And will somebody close the door? It's cold outside. It's cold outside. The floor at night, staring in his tiny face, swearing that I'll do my best to make for him a solid place. And barring acts of God or even acts of other men, I'll be the father that I always wished I had been allowed to see. Jesus, I'm a sucker, I wish I believed less of the lies. Did anything I thought I knew turn out to be true? 'Cause baby boys and little toys are all that I see anymore. And will somebody close the door? It's cold outside. It's cold outside.
Oh, what a conclusion. So I mentioned this last time because it happened twice. It doesn't always happen when you play your songs, but you ever watch American Idol? I guess I turn Rona here. Fantasia Barrino, who's been my favorite from the beginning, is, am I doing something wrong? She did Summertime, you know, the summertime and the living is easy. And there's this line that says, one of these days you're going to rise up singing. And it was a really, really great performance. I mean, like, just not a competition kind of performance, just like a really stirring performance. And at the end of it, she's crying, and Ryan Seacrest, the effusive host, says, "Why are you crying?" And she says, "Because I felt my song." And I just thought, well, what a great answer and what a great thing, you know, to feel it. And There's a quote from Frederick Buechner that I'd like to close with. I don't know exactly where we've gone during this whole thing, but as I said, maybe if I agitated a few strings, we're in good shape. So, Buechner says, if I were called upon to state in a few words the essence of everything I was trying to say, both as a novelist and as a preacher, it would be something like this. Listen to your life. See it for the fathomless mystery that it is, in the boredom and pain of it, no less than in the excitement and gladness. Touch, taste, smell your way to the holy and hidden heart of it, because in the last analysis, all moments are key moments, and life itself is grace. Let's pray. Father God, we're grateful for everything, for difficulties, for stubbing our toe sometimes, for getting angry, for being in touch with people that are difficult for us to deal with. We're grateful for happy things, like sunshine, like weather that's hot enough to cause you to sweat behind your knees, for baseball and little kids who run around and sprinklers. We're grateful for all the ways in which we understand you, all the ways in which we don't understand you. We ask that you would enable us and prepare us to listen better, to just do a better job of, instead of trying to control everything and manipulate things in the direction that we want them to go, to just sit or stand or lie down and have them be what they are. I mean, give us the strength and the courage, of course, you know, to act in the way that we need to act. But when something is beyond our action, just give us that ability to be at peace with the universe. And we know ultimately, Lord, that so much lies beyond our control, so much that we have to come to some satisfactory answer to the question of what is at the root of it. And we hope, God, in the way that Thomas Merton described hope, we hope that you are there, that at the basis of all things there is this incredible force of goodness and love and this incredible desire to see us made whole. And we just pray for all those things in the name of your Son and our Savior, Jesus. Amen.